Stephanie, I want to ask you a question based on sort of your position as sort of the interface of records between legal and business, Genentech. And I've been told, this question's evolved a little bit today. I've been told by more than a few that strategic records managers are hard to find. It's oftentimes an administrative position, and in the best of circumstances, you manage the life cycle of paper documents from a box storage until destruction, and maybe aren't experienced in talking at a C-level strategically about how to manage electronic information. I was talking to a record manager who doesn't fit that description at all today, who gave me another perspective that oftentimes IT people are in their own world, and legal and the IT people, sometimes you have to pry open their oyster shell to get them to work with you. So I think there's plenty of issues between these. You're sort of in it. Your background, you don't fit the description of a non-strategic thinker, and your job title incorporates both e-discover and records management. How do you manage this sort of three-headed monster?
You know, I think being that bridge to to IT and legal and records is, you know, a really critical part of my role. And I think being a lawyer, I have experience and insight in both records management and e-discovery. We still have traditional records management expertise, and I don't replace that, but I supplement it. And I think in the area of records management in particular, we're finding that it's helpful to have someone who not only knows records management principles, but who can identify the legal and regulatory requirements for record retention and then assess the risk related to business requirements that may exceed legal and regulatory ones. And so, you know, I think that that's part of the value that I add, being able to do that risk assessment and then being able to help formulate policy and education and processes that kind of balance that those requirements, business needs, and then risk. In the world of e-discovery, I think it's also necessary, you know, to have the folks who know how to locate the potentially relevant data, how to collect it, how to cull it, process, review it, produce it. But at the same time, it's critical to have someone who can talk to IT about the burdens associated with preserving or collecting ESI, and then who can kind of clarify and prioritize when necessary the legal obligations. So those are kind of the role where I see my role and value add.
Okay. I'm going to close out the record management section. One of my good friends, Tim Opsitnik, owns Jurnov, is an e-discovery technology expert, and he said a critical issue in the field of records management is not finding the tools which store records and then do a good job of storing them, but rather it's finding tools which enable you to produce the documents when litigation occurs, and that's when the fun really starts. Jonathan, since I know you're a good friend of Tim's as well, do you have any reaction to his question with this problem and what you can do to protect yourself if you're trying to evaluate these systems?
Yeah, Carl, I do, and I think Tim has been heard out in all the shops that are developing software and folks that do the records management, because what we're seeing, I think, in the world of solutions is that the records management solutions that are looking at electronically stored information have understood that the greatest risk factor that corporations are looking at now is a risk of a litigation failure, not a records management failure. The consequences of a litigation failure are much more dramatic, much more unpredictable. And so they've been changing. They've been looking at how their products work and don't work, and they've been trying to refine them to actually fit the litigation need. Now, what you've gotten in that world is, though, a hybrid. You've gotten some people that really thought through the problem, and then you've got some other people that have basically painted their truck a different color. So you've got to be very careful in looking at what solutions are being proposed by the vendors to understand that it really does have a litigation support, a litigation hold, and a collection kind of feature that will really work in your environment. And the critical thing here is to make sure you've got a rock-solid RFP process when you get to the proof of concept stage, that you're really able to test that what they've said their new and improved records management tool will do for litigation hold actually does it, because unfortunately we've found some instances where people have sort of had the painted truck and it doesn't really look or act like a Ferrari. It just isn't cutting it.
Okay, we're off schedule as always. We're going to go into the third section now. And this is, you know, the sort of the macro lessons shared by the pioneers on this panel. And I'm going to try to get this group to talk about what made them pioneers, share some of their tips. We may condense something creative I was going to try to do where we talked about the ideal world, and then we talk about the real world on implementing and purchasing these systems. But I'm going to encourage the panelists to feel free to jump in and add points if they'd like to someone else's tip. So this could either be like e-discovery jazz or it could be like my second grade history class when one student, Carl Schinnemann, used to have his arm up all the time and wouldn't shut up. Ooh, pick me. I know the answer. So we'll see what happens here. But in reverse alphabetical order, I'd like to know what made each of you take the steps to become sort of pioneers in this e-discovery electronic records field. Mike Scott?
I don't know if it was a step I took. It was one day I suddenly found I'd gotten this assignment at work. And I think what led to it is my first demand when I came back to Pittsburgh to the legal department and the IT group was I was going to use a Mac as opposed to the IBM shop that Alcoa was. That didn't go over very well. My Mac lasted about a year. But my relationship with the IT group and with technology aspects in the department and knowledge management aspects in the department, I think, grew from that as punishment.
Okay. Jonathan Redgrave?
Well, I'm not sure I like the word pioneer because it brings up visions of the Oregon Trail and lots of people dying. So I don't think I was ever engaged with the concept of being a pioneer in the field. It was more a sense of opportunity for me in looking at what needs were with respect to clients, and also a chance for my practice and what I do to spend a lot of time on proactive solutions, trying to help corporations think through things from a holistic and a more programmatic approach to try and get away from doing fire drills in this area. You'll always have fire drills with litigation, but if there's a way in which to get your programs more in tune with what will be expected, and then use that to leverage cost savings and efficiencies, and then, better yet, meet your compliance objectives. So there's really an opportunity to apply the knowledge I had from my various litigation background and my interest in technology to this space.
How about you, Neil?
Well, I would say that Cisco sort of looks at these issues in a core context model and says, you know, litigation generally and certainly litigation support is context and not core. And so the idea is to manage it, outsource it, and do it efficiently and save money. And if that's the goal here, you know, we looked at this and we said, well, what are the right metrics? And I think this would be the question or the point I would make to everyone is, you know, if you can measure something, then you can manage it successfully. So we looked at what is the right metric to figure out if we're doing this well, if we're being cost effective. And for a while, we looked at what's the cost for getting data from each particular custodian or witness, and that made sense in some cases and not other cases. And ultimately, we sort of said the best metric for us is what's the cost to find, process, and review a gigabyte of identified data. And working with vendors and internal folks here and to try to build processes that would drive down the cost of finding, reviewing, and producing a gigabyte of data so that you bring your cost down over time. And that's what I think has helped us be successful. It's not that we're perfect at this, but I think from a cost-benefit analysis, we're good enough and we're doing it very inexpensively. And today I would just say, you know, going forward, as I've said before, there's a bunch of new software tools out there that really should continue to help drive that down. So as we use that as our primary metric for how can we more and more inexpensively review and produce data, I'm looking at software tools that would allow me to do that.
Cliff?
I think my answer is very similar to Jonathan's. I serve at the pleasure of the clients that I support, and a lot of companies in this space have been lamenting how painful this is and how difficult it is, and it's a very reactive space. And I think Jonathan and I share a perspective where we're trying to get upstream, get to more of a proactive sense of how do we tie this back, where Jonathan's focus is on the legal side. I come from the business operations side to say, you know, we're spending a lot of money, we're doing a lot of these things where we need to capture this information, we need to share it collaboratively, we need to hold on to some of it, we need to reuse it and search for it and navigate to it. Why don't we think a couple of steps down the road and understand some of those end, those potential end result outcomes? And to Stephanie's point, you do this from a business operations standpoint. We rarely, from the business standpoint, think through to the end state where it might be landing in your core area from a litigation standpoint.
Okay, Stephanie?
You know, Carl, my background was handling complex product liability litigation that began to involve e-discovery about 7 or so years ago. So that's how I focused on e-discovery. And then helping clients handle their e-discovery led to many discussions about how to be more proactive to reduce the costs and risks related to e-discovery, with email education and record management programs being some of the most beneficial. So that's kind of how I began to focus. I think what really drove me to focus in this area was kind of the happy realization that I can practice law and talk to people other than lawyers a lot of the day, like technologists and other fun people. So that's what's kept me in it.
And Joe Kasich.
Well, it gives me a chance to talk about the money dance, because that's what did it for us. And that basically was having the realization that we had an awful lot of data that had to be reviewed, lots of emails, et cetera, documents, our internal documents, by external counsel who would charge us excessive amounts of money by the hour. And I heard all this noise on the conference call. I asked what it was, and they said it was the money dance, as they danced around the table, which led us to think, you know, we can do this as well. And that's really what initiated the development of an e-discovery and electronics record repository for our company that we still have today.
I'm going to sort of go into the next phase of this question on implementing systems. And Peter Gabriel had this great visual song called Secret World, and in his 94 tour he created this set list where he connected on a conveyor belt two worlds, one which is reality and one which is utopia, and they'd go back and forth, the musicians, to these two worlds. And I want to visit that theme now and start first with the utopia, with electronic records management, and trying to build a system the right way or without the pressure of litigation. Then I want to visit the messy world, which I think a lot of companies are in, where they start to analyze this when they get sued, and they try to build both systems. So, you know, when you look at this process of building a system in the perfect world, you know, Jonathan, you know, how do you start? Do you focus time on evaluating your process? How does process fit into this?
Well, it's an interesting question, Carl, because process is the key to really being able to manage and find compliant success in this world. And when the lawyers are involved driving a lot of things, process is something that in some ways they're good at, because they're very good at civil procedure and doing things. In other ways, understanding that you've got to go about records management and then tying it into a litigation system, they sometimes fall down and understanding the entire process of the business process of evaluating what needs are, doing true cost of ownership assessments, figuring out then how to do a proper request for information, getting in information in bids, how you analyze that, how you use project management to track how you're going from the RFI to the RFP to then down how you're actually going to build the system. Now, before all of this is a conceptualization that needs to go on as far as what is the data, what is the information that you're trying to actually manage, and how do you need to manage it. That invariably does get tied up with both the business needs and the regulatory needs for retention and destruction. But as much as we like utopia, we can't ignore the litigation backside. And quite frankly, I think it would be a mistake to try and just look at a utopian view and not understand that from the get-go, from the initial process of looking at systems you're going to create, to understand there's both the workers' management compliance and the litigation hold compliance aspect for those worlds. And then once you do that, having a process by which you can see it tracking from the generation of the idea of how you're going to manage the data through the actual development of systems that are now going to be able to intake the data from any of these applications, manage it for records management and legal hold purposes, and then dispose of it, destroy it, delete it at the end of that process. Looking at that programmatically before day one of data gets into the system is a utopian goal, and I think that the companies that actually look at this with a gating kind of concept are better off than those that just kind of let it happen, because you can't just dream about it. You've got to actually be involved in this from day one.
Cliff, then at that point, you've done a lot of thinking that Jonathan has gone through. How do you next attack the technology piece to build your perfect system or good system?
Well, I think Jonathan's made several points on this topic. Just to reflect a couple of those. First of all, these are large and complex. There's certainly some fragmentation in the market. There's a fair amount of consolidation going on in the core record space in the back end, but that's only one of several moving parts. You really need to think of this not as one, mother of all record systems, but really all companies have made investments in document repositories and content management systems. We're thinking about web content management. We're thinking about scanned images. We're thinking about e-forms, email. So we really need to understand all those things. But the key here is really getting a coherent strategy together, understanding, first of all, the business value in terms of your operational impact. If you're able to, through the same investment that's going to help with any possible eventual litigation support, if we're actually doing it because call centers can accelerate their ability to, resolve a call on the first escalation point and do it in half the time because they're able to find and access core transactional data or historical transactional data easier, better, faster. What is that worth to you, to your business for that example? The different kinds of things might need to be addressed differently. You might have, as we talked about earlier, specific people, specific document types, specific business events that have greater exposure from a risk and compliance standpoint. So this isn't in one fell swoop, you take away everybody's hard drive and save to this, massive black box server somewhere. This is really understand your requirements, put together a strategic roadmap, and then start thinking through how you're going to make those investments. And frankly, at this point, it is still a fragmented market that's changing rapidly. I watched one company sit for 8 months last year down to two software vendors for records management, and it was a bake-off. And just before they made their final decision between the two, one of them bought the other. So they're back to square one, and I think we'll be seeing more of that within the broader enterprise content management space.
All right, Mike, how do you get your money to pay for this? How do you decide who's going to pay for this?
Well, personally, I don't care whose budget it comes from. Certainly, it has to come from someone's, and you need to get – well, one tactic which we have used is virtually get leadership from legal, IT, and the CFO's office into a virtual room, convince them of the need, and then let them figure out how it's going to impact and whose budget it's going to impact. So at the end of the day, I don't think there's a right or a wrong answer beyond the immediate process of convincing the appropriate leadership, and hopefully you can do that without having a proverbial 2x4 hit the CFO or the CEO on the side of the head about a major litigation thing, that you can go forward and eventually you will get funding. It may not be all the funding that you require for the ultimate system. But as everyone has mentioned, you pick and choose and start with an accessible group of data, accessible group of people, build it out slowly, help that fit into your strategic roadmap that you have hopefully by this time created or are on the way to creating.
All right, I want to go to the messy side of the equation here. Well, first of all, Stephanie, do you have anything to add on who the players at the table? And if not, I'll ask you a different question. We may have already identified them, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's nothing new of legal, records management, CIT. The only thing I would add is that within CIT, I think you need to think about who you need at the table and make sure you have the right representatives so that, as Cliff alluded to, your strategy is coherent. So you need people from architecture, you need people from applications, probably people from operations. And then, of course, at some point, you'll involve probably select business users who can help, you know, identify the any gaps or requirements.
Okay, now for the messy question. This is the one I like. Stephanie, is it possible to do both e-discovery and electronic records management initiatives at the same time? And the way I look at it, it's sort of like taking Robitussin for a cough and drinking lots of orange juice at the same time in the hopes you stave off the next cold. Is this practical or impractical?
Well, I don't want to get too far down the road with your analogy, but OJ and Robitussin aren't contraindicated. And so, you know, it'd be great to drink OJ and take vitamins and start your exercise program before you got any cough. But, you know, the reality is, you know, you need to do the kind of proactive things that are necessary to maintain your health, and you have to, you know, deal with your cough when you get it. And so, you know, similarly, you need to address your record management, and you also have to prepare and manage your e-discovery as it comes up. Since e-discovery is really a point on the continuum of a records life cycle, proactive good management helps you better manage your e-discovery anyway. So, you know, it's hard, but yes, it's practical and necessary.
Okay. Jonathan, actually the reason I focus in on this area is I've heard a number of the listeners are in the evaluation stages of e-discovery and records management. They're also facing litigation at the same time. So do you have any suggestions here if you're behind the eight ball in this field and now you're facing litigation involving e-discovery? Do you go out and buy an email culling software and records management software at the same time?
Well, I think this question is kind of begging the answer that I'm not going to give that is either yes or no, and that's not really the case. You are always going to face, for most midsize and large corporations, some amount of litigation. If you waited for the decks to be clear before you tackled the records management software issue, whether it's focused on email or anything else, you'd never do anything. The courts don't require that you wait for the decks to be clear, but it's clear at the same time that the courts aren't going to be well disposed to a party that just goes out and just plugs in the system and, oh, by the way, it just kind of destroyed everything. We know the Rambus cases with various degrees of results from courts in Virginia and California and the FTC really looking at the implementation of a records management strategy, and that wasn't really focused as much on the technology. But if a court views someone imposing a records management strategy, including with technology, to just destroy stuff without regard to legal hold, you're going to face a world of problems. That does not mean that you shouldn't think about and find proper records management software solutions for your messaging, for your unstructured content, and your semi-structured content. If it's done well, that can aid and assist in the culling and collection of important, relevant information so you can have better compliance and you can explain why you've done that and why you in good faith believe the non-relevant information has been properly retained under the retention program, and that means destroyed if it's supposed to be destroyed. So it is something that I think people should not be too fearful of the litigation being this roadblock until it's gone. We can't really do something. You can responsibly go out, investigate, purchase, and implement systems. Again, though, you got to make sure you're very cognizant of what that's going to do to the information that is affected by legal holds.
I'm going to throw this to both Neil and Stephanie, in terms of finding the right technology for electronics records management when you're under the pressure of litigation, I was helping a company evaluate three products, and I mentioned them to over 40 experts nationally, and it amazed me how uneven the responses were. Is this still a very fragmented market? I think the only thing everyone agrees on is everything seems to be very expensive. So do you have any advice when you're under that pressure of how to evaluate systems and deal with a sticker shock?
Neil, why don't I start with some of the initial
sure.
You know, keys to me, and then you can take it from there. Yeah. I think that the two keys to me are defining your requirements and forming the right due diligence team. And, you know, they're very basic, but I think if you don't, it's easy not to do these two things, and if you don't, your effort is really totally compromised. With regard to requirements, it's really easy in this market to decide what you need based on what tools are available. And I think you have to step back and really consider what you're trying to achieve within your own organization and what needs the electronic document management system will meet. Beyond that, forming the right team is the other critical step so that you make sure you're, you know, leveraging the expertise that you have, that you're not, that your efforts aren't redundant, et cetera. So, Neil, beyond those kind of basic starting approaches, what would you
suggest? I just threw you into this, Neil, because you said there are a lot of cool tools out there that you're...
Well, you know, I think we're moving from a... to a software model on some of this stuff. But I think for us, we look at sort of two related but separate markets. One is tools that allow you to collect more quickly. And the second is tools that allow you, once that data is collected, is to review it more quickly and find themes and find the relevant stuff that you want. And they're both incredibly important. For collecting, you know, we talk to a number of vendors, and we basically say, here are the different places or databases or repositories where Cisco data is located. We have this much on hard drives and this much on servers and this much structured and unstructured, and ask them to come back, again, looking at a metric of how much it would cost per gigabyte to collect it. And so we look at that. And then separately, and I think here's where the really interesting tools are these days, is, you know, once it's collected, is to be able to put it into a software machine and, you know, just sort in every way, shape, and form imaginable. And I think that is right now, for me, the biggest cost savings is the ability to process data more quickly. Because if one of the biggest, you know, costs for any litigation department is attorney time in reviewing information and just learning a case, that is, I think, the ROI there is really great, because you can say, I can go back to my law firms and I can say, look at this software solution here, right? It should take you no time to get up to speed in cases now that you have this available to you. And I'll make it available through a VPN. You can do it, you know, use the tool at your own location. And then I think that, you know, so spending dollars to help lawyers more efficiently process data is almost always going to be money well spent. And, you know, you can, the people on the phone can look around and think, well, what am I spending on my outside counsel, and what is a typical case costing me, or what is the discovery aspect of that case costing me, and how much more efficient can it be? And then I've always, you know, used fixed fee agreements to put the onus on law firms to be efficient in that regard. But I think that's really the primary cost savings here is using technology to allow you to learn a case very quickly.
I would add one other metric to the dollar per gigabyte is some sort of accuracy measurement related to either time or some way related to getting the highest percentage of relevant records or documents out of your data set.
I think that also makes sense. I would go back to one other point. This is Neil again, about who's going to pay for this. You know, the legal department was asked to pay for a lot of this, and obviously we're an important part of it. But, you know, the analogy I use then is, you know, you might ask the legal department for advice that you're building a new building and you have to put in a ramp to make sure that you're compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act and get a legal opinion on how do you go about being compliant. So the legal department gives you that opinion. Don't then ask the legal department to build the ramp. Well, here, you know, this is just a reality of doing business in America, that companies are going to be involved in litigation from time to time, and the federal rules require a certain ability to, you know, to parse through electronically stored information. And so, yes, it's, you know, it's related to the legal team, but it's a cost of doing business in America, and I don't think it's one that should be disproportionately borne by the legal departments. That just, to me, doesn't make a lot of sense.
I'm going to try to use that one on my wife when she asks me to do something around the house next. But anyway, I want to move into the last phase here, which is the sort of the scary dream segment with critical issues that face e-discovery and records management looking out in the future. And, you know, I wanted to sort of go around the room and or around the phone and get a take from some of the panelists. What you see out there as being the scary areas, and what you think maybe some of the future solutions might be. And, you know, Mike, you started, we were talking about this before the call. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I guess for me, one of the
comforting aspects of scary areas is to note that others see similar issues to the ones we're facing at Alcoa, and that as frightening and as amorphous as some of our current structure and the current structure that we're implementing and the sometimes I feel fits and starts, is other people are about in the same place. Surprising how low on the scale, I think, if you had a group of people self-evaluate and people in litigation management or records management, and how they see that this is really at the beginning of the implementation, the management phase. But for me, I think the single most scary word that I hear within our information environment is single instance. And the concept not of bringing all the data globally into a single location for central management, yeah, it may be easier to find, but you're now going to have to manage it within that location to the various requirements of hundreds, potentially, of jurisdictions, not only with retention issues, but privacy issues related to transfer. This is going to occur with just general and liquidated in every litigated manner. And the other frightening thing, and I've mentioned the words before, and I've used them myself throughout my career, including but not limited to. You try and explain that to an IT person. It works when you talk to an individual custodian. But you go to an IT person, and they look at you, and they say, well, that means all, doesn't it? And in many cases, with many data sets, it really does. And how to translate that and make it work within both the records retention, I have been learning the difference, and the litigation context keeps me awake at night.
Joe Kasuf?
Well, the problem I see is it's becoming more and more of a challenge just to maintain records, and with so many devices, media that's available to everyone, and trying to understand where they're keeping it all. For example, in this company, we have multiple PCs. People have multiple laptops, email, different databases. There's in excess of 200 databases available to people to store information alone. So I see the biggest problem is trying to, it's like herding cats. You know, where are you keeping this stuff? What are you doing with it? And when we ask for it, and we need to locate where it is, somehow we need to know where all this equipment is and what's being stored on it. That seems to be the biggest challenge we have today.
Okay. And by the way, if anyone on the panel sees solutions to these bad dream things, feel free to chime them in. The disparate data issue is one that I've heard many Discovery people, a couple of my friends in the farm industry have just really struggled over this for the last, you know, 5 years. Jonathan Redgrave.
I think there's a couple things that I'd like to throw in here, one of which is already mentioned, and that really comes down to the problem that, you know, a long journey starts with a single step. And not to be overwhelmed, as some organizations are, about trying to solve everything. They need to pick certain things, usually triage it to the highest risk, and then get started on a project so you start to get your hands around it rather than just staring at disaster. Second thing, as far as maybe a doomsday, is the potential legacy data crisis. And by that, I mean the fact that we've got these new generations of all sorts of applications, other things coming out, and we haven't ever dealt with really the long-term storage and ultimate disposition of other incredibly large sets of data. But as far as a solution out there, Carl, I think this concept of making sure that there's this simple assessment that goes on, and maybe not so simple, but the process is simple, to make sure there's an assessment of every technology that's going to be deployed from conception to the point where it's actually being turned on for both records management compliance and legal hold compliance. And we should make that as rote in our organizations as putting on a seatbelt in a car. And we all know that, you know, if you don't put on a seatbelt, you know, a lot of times you'll drive, you'll be okay. But when you're in an accident and accidents happen, the failure to wear that can cause a lot more injuries. It should just be that simple. We should just say, you cut out the seatbelt law. Consider records management compliance. Consider legal hold compliance in every technology application project before it's ever deployed.
Neil, Ruben, you have anything to add here on bad dreams, et cetera?
Well, I think that the last few years it was sort of the weapons of mass discovery problem with PDAs proliferating, and it was sort of how do you go about it. And I think most companies have put in policies, ours has, that require, you know, whatever form you're using, it's got to be synced to the network. If it's owned by the company or provided by the company, it's got to be synced to the network. And so there's a slightly easier way of making sure that you're monitoring all these things. I think the two difficult things, one is, which one of the other speakers spoke about, is just Web 2.0 collaboration. That's the world we're all going into, and who owns that data, and is it in your possession, custody, or control, and how do you go about monitoring it when 1,000 people are adding to it from every continent in the globe all the time, and what is the final source of that information? I mean, that's going to be confusing. I don't think courts are requiring answers yet, but that's kind of where we're going. And then another issue, I think, which is really hard, we haven't talked about it today. It's a little beyond the scope here, but, you know, when you're in a global company, you have enormous privacy issues about going and collecting some of this data. And what you're allowed to collect in country A may not be what you're allowed to collect in country B. And so it's not just, you know, making sure that you don't lose the data. It's not making sure you can always get access to the data. But it's also the minefield. Are you even entitled to be mining that data?
There was one decision, I skipped over it because of the volume of material we could cover here today. But it's in the material called Phillips versus NetBlue. And Joe, I was going to ask you a question about that case. Neil brought up, you know, third-party Web 2.0 type of issues. You want to mention a couple points on that case?
Yeah, that case is troublesome in that, you know, they would expect someone to store data or evidence, really, that isn't their own. In that case, where they look to see if you received email and you were producing the email that had links to a number of websites and advertisements within those websites, defendant wanted the plaintiff to have provided that information. That, to me, you know, it's almost an impossible task. I think of my company here and all the advertising we do. If you go to a website, it changes, you know, every few minutes. And to think that we would expect someone to open a website and then think, gee, there may be problems with litigation in the future. I better save the web. Now I better save the link. Now I better save the URL. I better save the actual photo that I received in the email. Goes way beyond, and it goes beyond the duty to preserve evidence. And I think that was really what the key is with the court. And I was thankful to see in that case that they weren't going to rely solely on that. In fact, the good comment was that this is not a complaint regarding plaintiff's failure to preserve evidence, but rather plaintiff's alleged failure to gather evidence, which, you know, shouldn't be the case. I think that's still going to be up in the air because the court didn't really, you know, definitively end with that, saying that some of this would have to go back to a jury.
Okay, Stephanie, your sort of scary dreams out here in e-discovery.
You know, we hit on them. I think silos, decentralized information, and Web 2.0 is also really on my mind. I think, you know, the Web 2.0 raises just collaboration tools in general, and where is the information and how long are we maintaining this information is something that I'm trying to think about and focus on.
Okay. Cliff, on the business side, in building systems, what sort of bad things you want to create for this group?
So I'll be honest, it's hard to bat cleanup with this group on a similar topic. I think we've addressed all of the really big points. The only other small things waiting in the weeds, in addition to what we've covered, the whole notion of e-signature could be an interesting discussion point. The way it's being deployed today is a little inconsistent. Also, just Stephanie, in addition to the collaboration side of Web 2.0 and social software, there's the globalization of business, the globalization of work, and how we're now spreading We're doing straight-through processing on business events, so a discrete record is less common than a consolidated end-to-end record that might go inside and outside of the firewall, might go halfway around the world and back, and then get captured. And I guess finally, there's the notion, I think, Joe, you were talking about the organic nature of web content in this new social software environment. When is a record actually a complete record? If the whole point of this content is that it's constantly evolving organically, what's the point in time where you have to, you know, put a box around it? And with our personalization and customization capabilities, what are the implications there that what's being recreated for anyone it would look and act anything like what another person might see? The device proliferation that we're going through, you know, far beyond BlackBerries and PDAs, being able to do offline emulation, to be able to check things in and out, this consolidation of format types and collaborative tools, we're not done. And now when we're moving out to actually transacting business through avatars in Second Life, where actual currency conversion is taking place in an unregulated environment, it would be interesting to see, you know, what's going to happen from a legal perspective as that starts to get pulled into historical records.
This is, again, the concept of first records declaration within the enterprise and then the authentication and from a civil procedure, the overcoming, you know, hearsay exceptions based on business of record rule is something that is just boggles the mind.
Okay, I have a bunch of questions I can continue asking, and I've gotten a couple emails with questions from the group. So why don't we give instructions on how to send questions in, and then we'll start asking some of the questions that I've received as well as throw in a couple of these questions that I wanted to ask.
To join the question and answer session queue, please press 1 on your telephone keypad. I will announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Please remember that if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question.
Okay. You can also send p.reardon@bna.com questions, and they'll get to me. Here's a question from the audience. What's the best form in which to produce or receive data? As receiving party, don't you want to receive native files? Is judicial trend to the contrary? Let's see here. Jonathan, why don't you weigh in on that one?
Well, I will be happy to. The question, unfortunately, hopes for a simple answer, and there isn't one. It is really, for formal production, you need to understand what system it's coming from. It may make no difference in the world to you to get it in a native format versus a static format, especially if you've gotten a static format accompanied with load files for certain types of Word documents. On the other hand, if the production is focused on Excel spreadsheets, for example, you may very well say, I absolutely need those particular documents in native format. The Williams versus Sprint cases, Magistrate Judge Waxy in Kansas, are great illustrations of the pick your battles, pick your areas where you really want them. For example, in the first case, they went after Excel spreadsheets and said in the case, which was dealing with a reduction in force, we really need to see how they were calculating these things, including the formulas behind the numbers, and see if there are any notes in the spreadsheet. That says go ahead and do it. They then come back and say, well, we won that battle, we're going to ask for even more. Judge says, well, no, you haven't justified why you really need to get it, and there's some real concerns with respect to other types of documents in terms of disclosure of privileged information, non-relevant information, ability to track in a native format in terms of base numbering, et cetera, et cetera. So in that second case, the judge said, no, you're not going to get it in a native format. And from the standpoint of a requesting party, there are times when I really want it, but I would rather have, for instance, when I'm getting a database production from someone else, I want to know what the database is, what the fields are, what's available. Then I want the ability to tell them to run different reports, or even maybe I'll be able to inspect the database, but most likely that's not going to happen. So I'll ask for different reports to be run, and I know they preserve the data on the database, rather than saying, give me a huge tranche of information and data that might overwhelm me. And then for a lot of plaintiffs, or a lot of lawyers representing the requesting party, you don't have the resources to deal with a company if they really dumped on you all the native data, because then you need all the native applications to handle it. So don't think just because you've heard the word native that it's some sort of solution to everything. In certain cases, it is absolutely what you want, but understand what particular productions are going on. And the last thing here, Carl, is the fact that in any given production, there are going to be multiple different types of data that's at issue, and there may not be one form of production is going to be chosen. It might be a couple of different kinds of production in any one case.
Actually, that question about native format brings up an area from the scary section we didn't talk about, which is errors with metadata. And, you know, the metadata is, these are errors like when you have data about the date that a document was created or a file was created, and this date can be accidentally changed when the files are copied sometimes. And I guess there's some other issues with metadata and the lack of uniformity between devices and software. For example, a magnetic storage device such as a hard drive might have three-part date storage system when you create the document, when you accessed it, when you modified it, whereas the file architecture for an optical media device, such as a CDR, might only have one date, which it captures a date on. So this creates some difficulty in litigation when lawyers need to create chronologies. Now, I've read a number of articles that are interesting in this area about whether or not there can ever be uniformity in the metadata world. And Cliff, what are your thoughts on sort of the issues with metadata? Is this something that you've worked with at all?
I think I will defer to the more detailed question in this context to the folks who have had to do this at the time of discovery and talk through it. But at the highest level, metadata is a challenge in every organization, just operationally. Metadata in most organizations was not designed centrally at an enterprise level. It grows up over time within individual custom applications or in lines of business or product lines and supporting systems, and it's really evolved. You know, this concept where we have unstructured data versus structured data is a little bit of a misnomer, where there's so much that lives in the world of semi-structured data, and it's interesting. We talked earlier about this Googling notion, where Google has the ability to look at metadata. It also has the ability to look at content, but again, only within web content streams at this point. And really focuses on, you know, its algorithm is a popularity contest. So it makes sense in the internet, but not necessarily within an interior organization that has artificial constraints on it. So there's certainly some disciplines that have been brought in from an operational standpoint to improve metadata and master data at more of an enterprise level. And similarly, there are other discovery tools, search tools, not specifically focused on legal discovery, but just for everyday user search that's focused on sort of next generation algorithms that has more information theory built into it and has the ability to even look beyond the metadata and keyword tagging to find other things. But I think for the second part of your question, I think we really have to turn it over to the group.
Yeah, I just got an email from Jonathan about this. What's your take on this?
Well, the only thing I was going to add there, Carl, is the fact that when we're thinking about metadata, not to get confused that this is some all-knowing oracle from long ago in the age of mythology that tells us the truth. And one of the most known examples, or at least best known to me, is that people look at the metadata to see who actually created the document, and the reality is people cut and pasted in the Microsoft Office environment content between documents. They created new documents based off old documents, and people that have long since retired and even have been dead in organizations seem to be proliferating lots of new documents. And you know it's just not true. So that's one problem. And then the same thing is with respect to any data conversions that a company goes through in terms of the dates. You may have upgrades to new workstations, upgrades to new environments in terms of going from your 2000 platform to 2003, or maybe you've gone up to a Vista-type world. The reality is that sometimes the dates that are underlying those get changed in the conversion process. And so if you're doing date restriction searches based on the metadata alone, you might just be absolutely off because the content really doesn't necessarily track to what the metadata is. So you should not look at metadata as some sort of magic elixir that's the oracle that just tells you the truth. It's just another set of information. You need to understand what it is and what it isn't, and in any particular case, if there are limitations on its meaning and what you're going to do with it.
Okay, I've got a rather specific question that came through. What are the best e-discovery litigation software, and what's the cost to help law firms manage this in-house? And I don't know if anyone has a sense of several packages that are out there that seem to be moving in the right direction, or at least a protocol for evaluating the right system. Actually, Stephanie, since you're back, why don't I throw that to you?
I think there's a range of tools, and it depends on, what works for you depends on your litigation profile, on your computer systems. You know, there's things that you can get for little or no cost, for example, in the area of collection tools like Robocopy. Ghost, which may or may not work, there are issues with that, all the way up to Encase, which requires, a pretty significant investment. You have to look at, how much litigation you're involved in, the type of litigation. Is it, litigation that where forensic copies are necessary and going to be required? But those are some of the collection tools that I'm familiar with.
Another thing I would suggest is the ABA in their law practice management section has recently published an electronic evidence and discovery handbook, and it has in it a couple of useful starting checklists for looking at electronic discovery vendors and forensic experts, and some things to think about as you're preparing the questions you want to ask these people.
Well, that's a good point. If we're going to go there, also the Sedona conferences RFP guidance is maybe helpful on this point.
Cliff, I asked this question to a lawyer in February who on the show said he was hoping the legal industry didn't adopt Googling tools as a replacement for the critical process work needed to manage records and getting rid of them. Google's shown tremendous growth to become the dominant internet search engine, and they've created some desktop applications for searching for information on computers. In 9 years, they're now a $107 billion company, $10.5 billion in sales, and their mission is, quote, to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. As a technology implementer, are you seeing a movement to create more tools which incorporate the Googling techniques for corporate America to manage our records? And what do you think about my lawyer colleagues' concerns about losing the rigorous approach necessary to manage our information?
Well, I would think that everyone on this call would have some strong reservations about just turning over the historical discipline of the legal mindset and just turning that over to ad hoc queries. The reality of Google is it is excellent at what it does. It's phenomenal. They're a tremendous marketing organization. Within the unfettered world of the Internet, where there are no boundaries, their algorithm is essentially a popularity contest. The more times that somebody else points to you on a particular topic, the more likely that you're a more definitive source. That's an oversimplification, but that's sort of the heart of their page ranking system. So that works as long as you have the World Wide Web. Within organizations, first of all, not all your content is web content. In fact, the vast majority of what you're going to be dealing with will be scanned images and documents and emails and things that aren't readily returned within the recall of a Google-type appliance search. And in addition, there are artificial constraints in terms of how information is organized internally where the most popular answer may have nothing to do with whether it's the most valid source of that information. So there are other algorithms that can bring back search, but again, those have to be aimed at deliberately at certain repositories. They have to be trained to understand what to look for. They have to be able to prioritize and pull in all the various content types as well as all those different destinations. So the bigger challenges are less about the Google aspect of the search and more about federating all of those information repositories, putting the intelligence in on the front end to make sense of what you're trying to bring back. And then there's some semantic engines that will intelligently assess content at the time of creation and make some determinations about, you know, based on the content that appears, where does this maybe belong from a taxonomy standpoint. And that's a moving playing field as well, where we're seeing, you know, the concept of a taxonomy giving way to folksonomies and dynamic tagging and some other ways of organizing and classifying information to reflect the fact that some of us might come at that information from a very different mindset than others.
Let's talk about legal malpractice now among law firms for, say, mishandling e-discovery. Jonathan Redgrave, legal malpractice risk to outside counsel in 2007-2008 in the field of e-discovery. Is this real or imagined? Do you have any sense of this?
I believe it's real. I think there are a number of firms that should be very concerned, especially those that haven't really looked at this or understood the pain their clients are going through and prepared them. There's also a risk out here that's connected with all the e-discovery vendors that are running around, and that is who really is wearing what hats. We heard earlier in the call, I can't remember who mentioned it, but it was just a great point, that lawyers are very good at kind of spotting issues and saying we need to solve this, we need to preserve this. But then the problem is if the lawyers then go and say, well, we need to spin this tape, we need to pull this disc. No, stop. Explain to IT what you need pulled and go and do that. By the same token, vendors that are coming in to provide services, whether it's in helping you set up a system or helping you collect things in litigation process stuff, they do what they do very well, but they're also not lawyers. And if you improperly delegate to a non-lawyer that legal duty to provide advice and counsel on preservation duties and other steps along the way, that runs afoul of a number of the rules in terms of having proper supervision and making sure that lawyers are doing what lawyers are supposed to do. So I think there are real risks out there, both on the ethical side and then on the other side, with unhappy clients. Now, this idea of unhappy clients doesn't just go to those representing large corporations. If you don't give the right advice or you don't help them preserve what they need to preserve or you're handling e-discovery motions and it doesn't go well, and I don't see this as a large risk is going to run company, large law firms out of business, but I think it is a risk. It's probably going to be a larger risk for smaller firms, and then on the other side, those representing individual claimants. In the blog that Preston Gates, K&L Gates Law Firm runs, looking at cases from December through early this spring, I was amazed at how many sanctions cases were applying sanctions against individuals in lawsuits, the people that had the hard drive at home or other information that they deleted, destroyed, and their lawyers, where were they? I am seeing the possibility that there's going to be more and more malpractice action against the plaintiff's firms and others when the individual says, I lost my case because you didn't tell me the right thing to do, or on the flip side, this is the harder one to deal with, you would have won the case against the big corporation if you only would have pursued e-discovery harder and, you know, you didn't do it, and the pleadings don't show you even asking about emails or other things like that. Is that a far-fetched? Nah, it might be a bit of a stretch, but I think the reality is people see so much money flowing around and cases decided on sanctions issues, it's invariable that someone's going to second-guess. And so when you're looking at insurers, they're beginning to look at this area and saying to the law firms, do you have good practices in place? They're doing training programs for the law firms. So when the insurance companies are paying attention, I think the law firms should pay attention to say, hey, our risk has gone up. How much? Open question, Carl. But to your question, I think 2007, 2008, into 2009, we certainly see an elevated risk, and it's really incumbent upon law firms to respond to that risk.
From an inside perspective, and Joe, since you work in an insurance company, I'll give it to you. What's your expectation when it comes to outside counsel giving you advice in e-discovery and malpractice?
Well, I think it's, you know, as some of these cases show, that there's such a high level of expectation from the law firms that are doing some of this work for us, and for us it's not all that large a group, that we expect, you know, really a lot of communication, a lot of upfront information on what they're going to do and how. The counter to that is that we, as the owners of the data, really have to give them all the information they need. It's really our stuff. It's what we do. You know, it's our IT people, and there has to be a good coordination, because without, you know, the good coordination and knowing what you have and how to obtain it and everything, that outside firm can only do so much, and they're going to be hesitant to be, you know, representing your interests if you don't have the right information for them.
It seems to me this is also a little bit of a be careful what you wish for, in the sense of, as a very conservative position from the provided from the law firm to the client, and I see this more on the preservation side than the production, and constantly need to be reminded that the obligation to preserve is very different from the what eventually gets produced and is eventually discoverable. And at the end of the day, where there may have to be some difficult decisions made as to the full scope of the preservation, you may find yourself in heated discussions with outside counsel about what exactly will be preserved and where that fits on the continuum and what level of business risk you are willing to undertake in that regard.
I think that's one of the real challenges for outside counsel now. I think they have to get better at evaluating the real risk and obligations in a particular case, and also downstream. You know, the case law, the rules, the notes, all reflect an understanding that corporations don't have to keep all sources of potentially relevant ESI, and that keeping all of that ESI may actually create unnecessary burden and cost for the corporation. And I think it's outside counsel's job to understand the burden and cost and to evaluate the risks and make preservation recommendations based on those factors. You know, I think the analysis we're expecting is that it be thoughtful, that it be fact-based, and that it recognize that the most cautious approach isn't necessarily required or justified in each case.
Jonathan, there was a question I meant to ask you earlier about the movement of guidances from states. I'd read recently Maryland issued an opinion on e-discovery process. What do you see coming out of the states to help add clarity in this area?
Well, Carl, I think what you're referring to in Maryland is the protocol from the federal district court there, the local not rule, but a protocol. And so any number of districts are starting to promulgate either guidance or revising their existing guidance to reflect the new rules. I know Kansas has done that well. But the reality is that the state court system are still looking at this. New Jersey actually adopted a new rule to deal with ESI. Other states are going more deliberately along this way. But the reality is state court judges are looking at all the developments and saying we need to deal with ESI as well. The question will be, will all of the rules be the same? I think the answer in the short term is no, that certain courts or certain state court systems will look at things such as a two-tier and say we don't really need that. It's not doing anything more. It's not really adding that much to our approach to it. And so there's a effort from the National Uniform State Law Commission. They're going to be putting out a document. The state Supreme Court Chief Justices have gotten together. There's a guidance book that they put out. So there's a number of resources out there for state courts, and you're beginning to see more decisions at the district court level and state courts having to grapple with some of these e-discovery issues. So it really isn't just for federal court anymore. If you're appearing in state court, these issues are going to be in front of you. And for better or for worse, I think the state courts are going to be a little bit more deliberate in terms of do they follow the federal rules approach, lock, stock, and barrel, or do they make adjustments as we determine that maybe some adjustments are necessary?
I'd actually like to do another presentation in September or October focusing on the often ignored middle market company who's, say, you know, $3 billion, $500 million in revenue, and how they should be attacking the electronic records management mess, because it appears to me that there's less activity in that segment than in the larger company arena. Does anyone on the panel have any suggestions? I know most of the people aren't from larger companies, but from your experience level. Mike, why don't I start with you? I hadn't asked you a question in a while.
I was silent for a reason, in the sense of that there are
it's efficiency, I think, is what they're looking for.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that they can get at, but still efficiency and process and risk assessment, I think one of the points I made earlier is as you look at the sorts of program you want to develop in the strategic element for your company, it doesn't matter if you are subject to the SOX requirements, but you can look at some of the process and procedures and underlying, and some of that can help you in focusing efficiency. Also, attending a couple of conferences and attending legal tech or some other things once you sort of figure out where you're going is an efficient way of getting some information and exposure.
Okay. You know, one of the issues I run into is a number of quasi-startups, the small VC-funded companies that have tools to help in this area, seem to find me for some reason and ask me for advice on how to get connected with a company. Sometimes it's before they run out of money, even though they think they have the greatest application in the world. I was just curious if the battle that these companies are facing selling in the records management area is because the decision makers are so fragmented, you know, the three-headed leadership role that we talked about, records managers, legal, or operations, or are buyers really reluctant to buy new technology in this field, so the sales cycle's long. So I guess my question is, do you have any advice for a smaller company to how to get attention in this area? And I guess, Jonathan, since you've started a boutique that has national attention, what's your advice in trying to get attention?
Well, I think there's truly a longer sales cycle here, and I don't know if that's really a bad thing. I think that any organization that's getting into this, even the small organizations, have to apply a disciplined process to the purchasing. It is something that I think Stephanie mentioned, that having a good understanding of what your requirements are, that's a lot of upfront work, but boy, that's really going to save you down the road. So I think what we're going to see on the mid-sized firms in terms of where they're going to go is really focused on development of software that'll be more adaptable and scalable over the next 18 months, and there'll be more options available. Again, that will work in well with a longer sales cycle, and hopefully the companies understanding that there are going to be more products coming online realize that now is the time to be looking seriously at what your requirements are, not waiting for those products to come out. Don't buy the product and try to smash your information infrastructure around that product. You need to have a good understanding of how your infrastructure exist today. How are people actually using the information? What is the business all about, and how is IT supporting that business? Get that granular understanding, and then go out and figure out what the marketplace is giving as far as options.
Okay. I have a question here on legacy systems. And I'll throw it into an example I had here. I had personally spent about 200 hours converting my vinyl LPs, you know, those round things with holes in it that you played a needle over and played music. I was converting them into digital for my iPod. But I've heard that the shelf life for technology grows shorter and shorter. What do I do when the next form of music storage hits us that makes this obsolete? Put another way, for companies who are investing a fortune in the systems, what do they do when they turn into legacy systems in 5 years? And Mike or Joe, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, first thing,
Mike or Joe.
First thing is, whenever I talk to people and someone says we need to keep a document permanently, I say photography or paper. That I don't know of other guaranteed permanent storage medium. As anything else, you need to understand and have as part of your underlying process And that probably ends up with either the records or the IT organization, that the eventual migration and obsolescence and decommissioning of systems and associated ESI created by them and accessible through them needs to be an inherent and central part of your overall process in the development and your understanding of the system's life cycle.
Okay. I think that's roughly about it here. I want to thank everyone for joining in on the call and participating. It's another strong panel of with some great tips and insights into this this messy area. And you know, looking forward to doing a few more of these over the next year. So that's about it. You know, we'll look forward to the next one. And thanks for tuning in.